Hello, rich girls. Welcome back to Old Money, the podcast to help you build the trust fund you wish you were born with. I am your host, Amber Evenson, and I am contemplating changing that tagline to helping you build the nervous system that's going to keep you regulated even when things feel crazy. You're going to want to bookmark this episode for a rainy day or for when it feels like the sky is falling. We are currently living in such a crazy time. Whether it's the AI boom or the stock market correcting or silver and gold dropping off, Bitcoin at all-time lows, everything looking red, 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 down and to the right. It feels crazy out there. Now, I have one episode and I will link it in the show notes. It's called Unshakable and it's about cultivating an old money mindset in times of uncertainty. And while this episode is going to talk about regulating our nervous system and what we can actually do to regulate our nervous system in times of crisis, I wanted to take a practical approach to this as well. This is your doomsday preparation kit for when everything in your life or the world spirals out of control. Very simple things that you can do to proactively prepare for when the quote-unquote worst happens. No bunkers required. You do not have to stock up on toilet paper and Clorox wipes unless that's what makes you feel good. But I wanted to talk about the way being prepared can actually help regulate our nervous system because we know that we have the resources to pivot or take care of ourselves no matter what happens. So first of all, why does it feel like doomsday is coming all of the time? Well, we are in the doomsday industrial complex. The media, TikTok, Reddit, experts are all profiting from our fear. The more fearful the media makes us, the more we tune into the news, the more we engage, the more we spend time. Bad news spreads faster than boring competence. And of course, it's recency bias, right? We're living in it now. So it's very easy for us to overestimate how crazy things really are just because we're experiencing them. It's very different living through an economic downturn versus reading one in a textbook. But we cannot forget, if we look back in American history, we have a pretty checkered history if we're looking back in time, whether it's market crashes in 1987 or 1939 or the dot-com boom or 2008 housing crisis, or going back in time to things like the Civil War, Vietnam War, the Gulf War, civil rights. Like, always those things were happening. And as our society continues to evolve, we're always going to be put up against these inflection points where things really do feel like it's the end of the world. It's not a surprise that we panic. It's our evolution. It's our brain trying to keep us safe. We go into fight or flight, and our brain literally processes everything like a threat. It thinks that we need to run, we need to hide, we need to fight. It processes the news. It processes a market correction, everything like a physical threat, which causes us to be dysregulated, and we are not making good decisions when we're dysregulated. And this is not something that has anything to do with how much money you have in the bank, because rich people panic too. I mean, looking back at the 2008 financial crisis, plenty of high net worth families and executives watched their portfolios get cut in half or worse, and then they panicked into selling at the bottom. The wealthy were not immune to feeling like everything was on fire. It really was for them. But again, when you're in fight or flight, you are not thinking about history. You are not thinking about market corrections. You are in the moment thinking, what do I do to get out? I want to hoard my money. I want to get out what I can. But when you have a regulated nervous system, your prefrontal cortex is operating, your amygdala hasn't taken over the capacity of your brain, you're able to look back at 1987, 1939 and think, okay, there's going to be a recovery here. How do I navigate through this? Or Bernie Madoff is a really good example. Like, this guy was capable of massive fraud, and it wasn't a Jen Shah situation. He wasn't preying on the elderly who had no idea they were being scammed because they weren't financially educated. He was preying on wealthy individuals and foundations and socially prominent families. Their money didn't protect them from being swindled or being scammed. It can happen to anybody. And if we even look back at COVID, which is too recent in all of our memories. How did we act at the beginning of the pandemic? There was, in my opinion, mass hysteria fueled by the media, 1000%. But also, it's not just the media's fault. Like, we were faced with a black swan event, something that had never happened before. And when we are in a state of fear, fearful for our lives, not sure if our parents are safe, elderly people in our community are safe, our kids are safe, you act in a very different way when you are trying to survive. Raise your hand if you Lysoled your Amazon packages. Nobody knew what was going on. We were all relying on data that was coming out way too fast, was really disorganized. It was an actual disaster. So nobody's immune from feeling fear when something crazy is happening. In fact, not only does money not make you immune, it actually makes you more vulnerable. Because if you don't have structure, more money can mean more to lose, more to manage, and more pressure to get it right. Wealth gives you options, but it doesn't give you emotional regulation. And if you do not have emotional regulation or protections in place, then you have a lot more to lose if something goes wrong. As I said in the previous episode that I have replayed so many times, I don't remember what episode number it is, but again, I'll link it in the show notes, and it's a good one when you're feeling a little shaky. The goal isn't to be rich. The goal is to be unshakable. And that comes from systems, learning how to regulate your nervous system when you recognize that you're feeling triggered, flooded, or just feeling off. It comes from systems like cash reserves, clear plans, insurance, a diversified investment account, and boundaries. By the by, this is not just talking about crazy economic stuff. It's not talking about pandemics and big pictures. It's not talking about only looking at who's in office or what's going on or what files are getting released. It's talking about stuff that happens at the personal level, like in our homes. Because tell me if you are going to feel totally calm if you lose your job or you have an accident and have a huge medical bill or, God forbid, and cancel clear all of this negative energy when something bad happens and you don't have the money for it. Having a regulated nervous system in those times of absolute struggle, I mean, it's a different ball game, and it's still going to throw you for a loop. Like, let's just be honest. We are humans. We are emotional creatures. We care about our families, ourselves, our safety, and life may serve you something on a dish that you don't want to eat. And we need to make sure that we're prepared for that, to give ourselves the best chance of not just surviving it, but thriving through any financial challenge. Because having a regulated nervous system is not being composed all of the time. It's about being able to respond to something instead of react. It's about noticing when we are triggered. It's about making sure that we're not making huge decisions about our lives when we're dysregulated. It's the ability to stay steady when things get rocky and to be slow when others rush and to think clearly under pressure. This is not about looking a certain way or being a certain way or dressing a certain way. It's about being able to take in all the information and make good decisions for yourself that don't cause you more problems later. So before we go into what it means to have a financial doomsday plan, let's also talk about the crazy side of it, because I think that's what we see a lot of on television. Like, if you are a doomsday prepper, you are considered crazy in the society. People laugh at you and say, oh my gosh, you think the world's coming to an end. And I don't actually agree with that. I think that people who are thinking about all the possibilities and are prepared for anything are the type of people I want to be around. To give you an example, like, a doomsday prep situation doesn't mean that it's going to be a zombie apocalypse, but there's a very good chance that there could be a serious earthquake or a power outage or issues with a power grid or Wi-Fi, or ways that we wouldn't know how to live our day-to-day life as normal. Maybe there's a run on the banks. Maybe there's issues with the roads and we can't get groceries. How do I plan for that? I'll tell you, and you can judge me all you want. We have extra dog food at all times because I gotta make sure Poppy's getting her meals. We keep water for reserves in case something happens. We have talked about with our families what to do if something like that happens and that nobody's gonna panic and who's gonna go where. We have means of communication that are not reliant on cell phones or Wi-Fi. We have batteries and flashlights and MREs or whatever it is that we need, like canned food. I always just keep a little bit in the pantry because, yeah, what if there is something like I get hurt or I get really sick and I can't go to the grocery store? Like, what do you do? The other thing that I think is really important about this is making sure that you have strong community ties, because you cannot go through chaos or a doomsday situation, whether it's a power outage or, you know, a run on the banks, without support of your family, of your friends, of your neighbors. And it's through community that we can really make sure that we survive this. But when we talk about financial doomsday, let me tell you what financial doomsday prepping is not and what I would not recommend. First and foremost, for the love of God, please do not keep cash under your mattress in shoeboxes. I know somebody, I've told this story before, whose grandfather was a very successful businessman. He was also a survivor of the Holocaust, and he had a lot of mistrust of authority and banks. Wouldn't you, if that was your lived experience? My goodness, I completely, completely empathize and understand. And this man was so successful, he had shoeboxes stacked around rooms at the perimeter of the room, all the way around at the baseboards, shoeboxes full of cash. And then on top of those shoeboxes were more shoeboxes. So it went all the way up the wall, all the way around the room. And then when that got full, the next layer in started. So there was one layer of shoeboxes all the way to the ceiling, all the way around the room. And then the next layer in, another row of shoeboxes all the way in. And then another row of shoeboxes, as much as could be stacked on top of each other, because he didn't trust anyone. And this is a major problem for a few reasons. I will point you to Exhibit A, the fires in Altadena, and Pacific Palisades in January of 2025. Can you imagine if your life savings went up in flames, literally? Talk about financial doomsday, like you are screwed. Number two, it makes you so vulnerable to theft. And number three, it is deflating faster than it's growing. You just cannot keep money under your mattress or in shoeboxes. Let me tell you another thing that is not financial preparedness. Buying a Cybertruck and telling me that it is your plan to survive the end of the world. I didn't even know this until recently, but apparently a Cybertruck has solar panels and it's built to withstand, like maybe it's bulletproof, I'm not really sure. It's built to withstand the end of the world so that it can be a Cybertruck like over the apocalyptic landscape. I did not know that, but that does not give you an excuse to buy a Cybertruck. Also, stockpiling, gold, ammunition, guns, that is not a doomsday plan for when things go wrong with your money. Or pulling all of your investments because one podcast sounded very convincing about investing everything into Polymarket or Bitcoin or whatever this new Reddit stock is. Absolutely not. It's why I always say, and I say it as a joke, but I mean it, like, this is not financial advice. This is just my opinion on things. I am not out here telling you where to put your money. And it is crazy that people like Jim Cramer on CNBC or whatever channel he's on can tell you what stocks are hot and then it's always wrong. Another thing I'm gonna ask you to not do to prep for financial doomsday is to just refuse to enjoy your money because something could happen. You guys, something always happens. So like you have to live your life, And you can't make big decisions when you're doom scrolling at midnight on Reddit or TikTok. You cannot hoard emergency funds. There are so many things that you can do wrong, which is all about reaction. This is all about theatrics. This is not actually what financial preparedness is. Let me tell you how I would prepare for financial doomsday, like the survival kit, the real thing, the practical, not sexy, essential things to do to prepare for that rainy day. To set the stage, we need to first talk about liquidity. Liquidity, which is one of my favorite water words for money, is meaning that you have access to cash. And I mean that can either be in the form of physical cash, it can be in a checking account, it can be someplace that you can get it out quickly from a bank. Non-liquid doesn't necessarily mean frozen. A frozen asset is an asset that you cannot reach, cash that is not accessible to you, meaning it is tied up somewhere for some agreement. Maybe it's in a certificate of deposit that you can't get for 10 years, or it's tied up in a trust that you don't have access to until a certain milestone, or you're in trouble with the IRS and they have frozen your accounts and you cannot get to them, you cannot use your money. There's something in between. And typically when we talk about high yield savings accounts, I typically recommend that your high yield savings accounts are in a place that's separate from your main banking institution. So it's kind of out of sight, out of mind, and you can let those accounts grow independently of your everyday transactions. Another reason why it's separate from your Wells Fargo, your Chase, your Bank of America is because Wells Fargo, Chase, and Bank of America don't actually offer high yield savings accounts that give you good rates. Places like Capital One or Ally do. And most of those places are actually online banks. So it would take you a couple of days to initiate a transfer from your high yield savings account over to your checking account if you needed it. And it's not usually easily accessible via an ATM or a physical bank. I use Capital One for my high yield savings accounts, and they do have Capital One cafes. You can have a Capital One 360 checking account, but I don't even have a debit card for my savings accounts. Everything that I own in my savings accounts is all digital, meaning that that money is not immediately liquid. Yes, I can transfer it in 3 to 5 business days, but it's not liquid money. Another example of non-liquid money would be money that's tied up in an investment. That could be money that you have in the stock market, in an ETF, in a mutual fund, where you would need to sell that mutual fund, that stock, or that ETF in order to get the money into a money market account and then withdraw it. Again, it's likely that number one, you have to wait to make the trade. Number two, you have to wait till that trade is executed. Number three, it's unlikely that you have direct cash access to that particular money market fund. I mean, of course, you can, again, have a Schwab checking account, blah, 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 but I'm just talking in generalities. Another reason your money might not be liquid is because it's tied up in an asset like a home or a car or some sort of physical asset that you can't get it unless you sell it. So let's compare the different situations. Let's say you have $100,000, and don't scoff at me, sister. $100,000 for you to do something with is in your future. Claim that energy right now. You have $100,000. What are you going to do with that $100,000? Let's talk about all the places you could put it and the pros and cons. You could have $100,000 in cash, and it could be in your wallet or in your purse. Not a great place. It could be in a shoebox. Not a great place. You could deposit that $100,000 into your checking account. It would sit there. It would earn no interest. Okay, you have $100,000 in your checking account. You're probably going to spend it. It's not earning interest. You can put it in your Wells Fargo savings account. It's also going to have a very low interest rate. You're probably not going to make a ton of money on it, but it's there and it's being saved, and it's $100,000 and it's FDIC insured. You could put it in a high yield savings account. High yield savings account is a different type of account that just gives you a better interest rate on your money. So maybe you move it over to Capital One and the interest rate is 3.5%. So you leave it there for a year, and in a year you've earned $3,500 in interest. Where else could we put this $100,000? Well, we could put it into an ETF or a mutual fund or a stock. We would transfer it into our Schwab or Robinhood or whatever platform, Vanguard, you use to buy and trade stocks, and you would invest in those stocks or funds or whatever makes sense to you. So that's where your $100,000 lives. Or you could take that $100,000 and you could use it as a down payment on a house. And then you would move that asset from $100,000 in cash to $100,000 of equity in your home because you used it as a down payment. Or you could take that $100,000 and go to the Mercedes-Benz dealership and buy a baby blue G-Wagon. And it might cost you $100,000 to purchase that car and drive it off the lot, but the value of the car is going to be less after you take it off the lot. So whoops, but at least you have a $100,000 car, right? You have all of these different ways to deal with $100,000. You might also take your $100,000 to Hermes, and you might buy, how many Birkins can you get for $100,000? Let's do the math, between $12,000 and $15,000 per Birkin. So you can get probably like 6 or 7 Birkins with tax at Hermes. And so now you have an investment in bags. Whatever you do with your money is up to you, but the right decision for you is going to be based on your personal risk stack. What matters most for you? If you have $100,000 in cash, you're like, I would never go to Hermes and blow it all on bags. But if you have a home that's fully paid for, your retirement already set, vacations already booked, no debt, you're good as gold. You don't have a need for any of these other kind of survival mechanisms, so you can spend $100,000 at Hermes. And your personal risk stack is going to be different person to person, right? Because maybe you're a woman listening to this and your family is you and your cat. Maybe your family is you and four kids and you're a single mom. Maybe your family is you and a kid or two and a dog and your partner is the breadwinner. Who knows what your personal circumstance is, but your personal risk stack is going to be the thing that determines how much of what action you take or how much money you need to have in an emergency fund. And that's why one-size-all advice fails. Like everybody says, oh, you can only spend 50% of your income on essentials and 30% on your wants and 20% in saving and investment. Well, that's one-size-fits-all advice I hear all the time. I personally don't subscribe to it because your quote-unquote housing is a need, right? It's an essential spend, but a lot of people have overpurchased their house or they live in a very high cost of living area when they don't need to, right? That's a lifestyle choice. So the choices between needs and wants and blah, 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 it's all very muddy. My point is this. We need to talk about things in generalities, but there's some non-negotiables here that I think are going to help you. And one of the first things you can do to get out of financial fight or flight is to really understand your numbers. Understanding your numbers and spending time with your money on a regular basis so you know how it flows through your life, you know how much you have, you know how much you spend. That's what defines what a real doomsday kit is. Because the first thing you need to do to prepare for financial doomsday, and I'm talking about you get laid off, there's another COVID, there's some black swan event, you lose your job, but you get injured, whatever, is you need a real emergency fund. And not just 6 months of what you spend every month because someone said so. This is money that you're using to buy time. Okay, the emergency fund is, we got to rebrand the emergency fund because the emergency fund has to be enough money to buy you time to navigate through whatever it is you have to navigate through and you don't have to stress because financial stress is so detrimental. It's just the fastest way to throw you into fight or flight. And if something negative happens to you or to someone in your family, the last thing you want to be worried about is, do I have enough money to pay my bills? Do I have enough money to keep the lights on? Do I have enough money to feed my children? So the emergency fund calculation is anywhere between 3 and 6, even more, 12 months of how much you spend on essentials every month. This is, I lost my job, so I'm not getting my Russian manicures every month. I'm not shopping at Aritzia every week. I'm not doing this, I'm not doing that. You're taking a real stock of, okay, if this scenario were to happen or that scenario were to happen, how much money do I need every single month? And how much runway do I need? So you'll notice a couple of things. The number that's the monthly emergency fund that you need is going to be determined based on your circumstances. And the other thing is the runway, the how many months of time do I need to buy? If you are in a industry or you're looking at the job market and you're saying, wow, it's looking like it's actually taking people 3 months or 6 months to find a new job instead of 3 weeks or 6 weeks because things are shifting, maybe your 3 month emergency fund in a very competitive environment and where you work is not going to give you enough time that you need to really replace your income. And you have to think about things also like the hidden costs of unemployment. Like, not only are you not going to have income coming in, but you're not probably going to be saving money like you were. You're not going to be adding to your coffers at that time. You're not going to be investing. Maybe you need to get COBRA for insurance in the middle of unemployment. When we talk about an emergency fund related to a job loss, got to make sure you think about everything altogether so that you can calculate how much money you should have in the bank so that you can keep your nervous system regulated and that you have a plan B or a plan C. Like, okay, if I don't get a job in 3 months, I can move in with my parents for this amount of time and save this much money. Nobody talks about this. It's not a fun conversation financially, and that's why I'm trying to make it a little silly and a little fun by making this doomsday. But these are the types of conversations that need to be had so that you can maintain regulation when things get choppy. The second thing I would focus on here that's separate from emergency fund, but it's still savings, is thinking about your insurance deductibles. Those are non-negotiable. You need to understand your numbers around how much money you would need to pay out of pocket annually for medical expenses, for auto insurance, for homeowners or renters insurance. Being insured is not the same as being protected. Somebody that worked for me, I love her so much. She worked for me, and it was a crazy time in her town in Ohio where there were storms that were coming through all of the time. And out of the blue, she wakes up to take her kids to school. She has four kids. There is a full-on tree from her neighbor's yard that fell onto their family car and crushed it. It crushed the car. It was completely totaled. The car was done for. And so, yeah, that is not only an inconvenience. You need to be getting a rental car in the meantime or Ubers to get your kids to school that day, doing whatever you need to do to make up for time that you can't get to work. You need to have coverage with your auto insurance. And then get this, you guys, this is not a joke. This is a real story. The same thing happened to her daughter's car like 3 weeks later. They had two trees fall on two separate cars within the span of like 2 weeks. Freak accident, you guys, it's crazy. And then just remember this little tidbit. The trees were from the neighbor's yard. So this wasn't something that their home insurance was going to cover. Yeah, their auto insurance covered it, but their home insurance didn't cover any of the gap of all of those out-of-pocket expenses. And what happens when your neighbor doesn't have homeowners or renters insurance? It's real stuff that can happen. And then same thing with medical insurance. You need to understand how much your family needs for out-of-pocket expenses per year. My recommendation, and I gave this to Allie O'Brien on her podcast, Clean Truths. We talked a lot about having enough money in an account to cover all of your insurance deductibles for the year. That is the real emergency, the medical, the auto, and the home. And I'm telling you something, guys, my brain chemistry changed the week that I adopted Poppy. I got her from a shelter. She had been found on the side of the road, hit by a car. I took her home. She was good for the first week. At the end of the first week, she started to get really sick. I could tell. I didn't know what was wrong with her. I could tell she had super high liver elevation. She had trauma of her liver that was causing everything to be out of whack. She was touch and go. I had a vet tell me that she was a goner. I was a disaster for the week. Let me remind you, this is where this whole story of my financial dysregulation really started. I dropped her off at this vet. I call my mom. I'm crying. I'm driving into the Carlsbad Forum to go shopping for candles at Anthropology, even though I'm already in debt because I think the candles are going to make me feel better. I'm crying so hard that as I'm pulling into the parking spot, I sideswipe a Volvo and scrape up the whole side of a brand new car. And I was like, fuck, I am in so deep. Not to mention Poppy's vet bills were $10,000, but I figured it out. I paid it all off. I got it done. I asked for help. I didn't get any, and it's okay. But what wasn't okay was a late night that I was at this vet in San Marcos. It was COVID. We were waiting outside. We weren't allowed in. And this woman was sobbing because she couldn't afford the care that her dog needed. And it was at that moment where I was like, that will never happen to me. So immediately I got pet insurance, which is so important. I pay $100 a month for Poppy because she is a high-risk baby, and she's not a baby anymore. She's like 8 and a half. And I also have a savings account for her. So there will never be a time when I have to make a decision to save my dog's life based on how much money that I have. That is, for me, regulation. It is the insurance policy that I need to know that no matter what, I'm going to get her the best specialist, the best care, and do everything in my power to make sure that I protect that little dog. And that's what this is about. The emergency fund is protecting yourself and your family in the case of something happening. The insurance deductible fund is making sure that no matter what, you are covered and you can take care of yourself when the worst happens so that you can take care of yourself. when we're talking about job loss math, or, you know, if you get injured, for example, this is also where a lot of kind of, I would say, flaws in the system come alive. And there's something called the hidden frugality test, which is asking yourself, what would break me financially in 30 days? That is stress testing your life. And it's one of the reasons why paying off debt is so important, because those debt payments can stack up and eat away so much of your power to not only save money for experiences like this, but also because if something in your life happens and you can't work for 30 days or 60 days, or you get sick or you lose your job, it's those debt payments that are gonna come to bite you in the butt. You don't wanna be beholden to anyone or any credit card company if you don't have to be. And again, I wanna just underscore, this is not something that more money just solves the problem of. That's why they say, and I hate this phrase, but more money, more problems, because even as you scale up in your life and you take on more debt for cars or homes or second homes or whatever it is, you're owing so much more money, you're levered. And when things go wrong, it's not that people are bad with money, it's just that they're under buffered. They don't have the systems in place. The buffer, you guys, is peace. The buffer is peace. Time is money, but money can also be time. It can buy you time when you need it. And speaking of buying things, this goes into the next section of opportunity for creating your doomsday kit, which is actually something that Justin and I have been talking a lot about. And it is about having dry powder, as they call it, which is funny because I just told you that like stockpiling ammunition is not going to save you from financial ruin. It might save you from a zombie apocalypse, but it's not going to save you when you lose your job or get sick or there's another COVID, right? But what dry powder means is having cash. It means having something that you can, quote unquote, put in the gun or whatever. Like, I don't know what you use dry powder for in like a cannon if you're on a pirate ship. But dry powder is cash. And it's cash that you're holding for a specific reason. It's to take advantage of opportunities when they come up. Having dry powder in the times of an economic downturn, a market correction, or a market crash is why they say more millionaires are made during recessions than any other time. Because when people have cash and they can invest when the markets are low, they're not necessarily timing the market, but they're using the cash for flexibility and optioning to put more in to optimize the return, because they believe that the period of time that they choose to invest when the market has gone down or corrected or crashed or whatever, they think that the market will return to the mean or return to the average of where it was, or it will go back up, meaning that they're buying low, they're buying the dip. Here's the thing. You cannot time the market. This is a strategy to use on top of dollar cost averaging, meaning you're regularly buying in at regular intervals to the funds or the stocks that you care about so that you average out your purchase price over time. But the concept of dry powder is not about saving yourself with an emergency fund during a job loss or sickness. It's not about making sure you have insurance deductibles. This is after all of that is covered and you have fun money to play with and have to invest. But like, let's not be a hero, okay? Dollar cost averaging is the emotional regulation. It's the emotional protection, honestly. Buying the dip is speculative. It is not an investment strategy. Boggleheads know that simplicity beats cleverness. Time in the market outweighs anything, any prediction. So you can have some dry powder sitting on the sidelines, but you don't want to sit out waiting for a market dip and then you put all your money in at that time, then the market continues to tumble. All in and all out are both emotional decisions. And so when I talk about dry powder, personally speaking, I'm not talking about having my entire retirement fund sitting in dry powder waiting to quote unquote buy the dip. I'm talking about back in 2020 when we saw Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos and Warren Buffett and Mark Zuckerberg and Peter Thiel and, you know, every Tom, Dick, and Harry out there buy a ton of stock when shit hit the fan in April of 2020 and everything crashed. We all of the normal people, myself included, were in this recency bias of like, holy shit, there's a pandemic happening. I gotta just like make sure I stay safe and spray my neighbors with Lysol in the mouth because I'm terrified of dying. And they're looking at the market over this span of time, looking at this as a black swan event, which is what it was, zooming out, having perspective and saying, this is a market correction. Based on this event, it will return to the mean. I'm going to buy low. And they did that without ruining their nervous system because they also have tons of money invested in other places. It wasn't their entire strategy for building wealth. Do you see what I'm saying? So having dry powder on the side is cash as flexibility, not as market timing. It's an opportunity. And it is one of the reasons why when things correct, if you, for example, are interested in purchasing a home and you're singing the same song that most Americans are, like it's way too expensive to buy a home right now. Interest rates are crazy. Home prices are crazy. What if everything changed tomorrow? What if the opportunity was like 2009 tomorrow, and all of these homes start to become available, and there's one that you really want? Do you have the dry powder available to take advantage of that opportunity? If everything changed and you wanted to buy a house, could you go do that tomorrow? That's what we talk about, having dry powder. The dry powder is part of the doomsday kit because it's about taking advantage of when things go bad for your future self. It's not all in or all out thinking. It's not an extreme. It's about having this set of money aside so that you can make a move when the market benefits you. Does that resonate? So we've gone through three specific funds for the doomsday kit, right? And we talked about this first about liquidity, what that means, where your money lives. And we also talked about your personal risk stack is going to determine all these things. The three different funds are your emergency fund, your insurance deductible fund, and your dry powder fund. And you're thinking, Amber, you are all work and no play. I'm trying to get a Birkin this year. And I'm like, sister, I know, but here's the thing. This is about long-term emotional support for yourself when things get crazy, because we're here to get out of financial fight or flight. This is about rules over reaction. This is about pre-deciding what your moves are going to be so panic doesn't decide for you. This is my emotional insurance policy. This is why I can afford to ignore the headlines. Because I'm not affected by all of these market fluctuations. I'm not affected by how crazy the president is acting. And before you come for my neck, it's not that I don't care about what's going on in the world. It's not that I have my head in the sand. It's not that I think that what's happening in the world is okay. I'm not giving anything or anyone a pass on a morality standpoint. It's about my nervous system and the way that I show up in the world is my responsibility. And so I have decided to do these things to make sure that no matter what is happening, I'm okay and I can take care of my family. That's the most important thing first. I have firm boundaries around my money. I have firm boundaries around my energy. I know when to stop consuming financial news. I know when to stop consuming Reddit headlines. I just don't know when to stop consuming Veuve Clicquot. Like, that's my problem, right? But I do also have a framework and a formula in my mind. I've actually thought about the things. Like, if X happens, I do Y. Like, if the market crashes, I do this. I've thought about it ahead of time. It's kind of like when we used to do stop, drop, and roll scenarios in school, or we used to do earthquake preparedness. I am hearing now, and this is absolutely sickening to me, that we have to do active shooter drills with kids in schools. But it's better to do that. It's a reality of the disgusting nation we live in today. And would you rather have your kid do the drill or not have them know what to do when something bad happened? It's one of the realities of being an adult. We have to think about what to do when things go wrong. And if we avoid it because it's uncomfortable to think about, then we will not know how we want to react. We know that our brains can rehearse. We can use our imagination to predict things. And I think this is about being prepared. This is not about being pessimistic, because I actually don't think the sky is falling. I'm just here to limit my own personal volatility, both emotionally and financially, should something go wrong. So if this whole episode hasn't triggered you enough already, let me tell you five really easy things, really easy regulating things that you can do with your family by yourself to feel calm and competent and powerful no matter what happens, okay? First thing is know your numbers. As I said, uncertainty is what's going to spike your anxiety. So if you know your baseline monthly expenses, your cash runway, your debt obligations, how much you have in savings, you don't need a perfect spreadsheet. You need rough numbers that you can recall without breaking a sweat. When you are familiar with your numbers, it's going to breed calm. Like you're just going to feel comfortable with it, right? More exposure makes you feel more regulated and more calm. Number two, you're going to set up your funds. You're going to have an emergency fund, an insurance deductible fund, a dry powder fund. The priority goes in that order: emergency fund, insurance fund, and the dry powder fund. That's when everything else is going really good. I recommend that you set these up in a high yield savings account, and you go on to item number three. Automate what you can. Regulation loves being predictable. So when you have automatic transfers, when you have your money automatically moving into those funds, they're going to grow without your effort. Your effort is a one-time thing. You set up the automatic transfers on a monthly or bi-monthly basis, and then they just grow without you having to do anything. It also reduces decision fatigue. You don't have to remember to do this. It reduces your need to lean on willpower to fund these funds. And over time, you just stop noticing the money's there. It's true. It is a nervous system savior. I swear I love automation. If you need help with automation, and I'm talking about automation for bill pay, for savings, for investing, for just managing your money with as little effort as possible, it's all there for you in my course, Old Money Method, a step-by-step program, 5 different sections and modules with a bonus module on how to stop overspending and stop letting your nervous system be dysregulated to run your financial show. It's all in there. So step number three is automate what you can, automatic transfer, scheduled bill pay, default investing, let it all be automated. Item number four is notice your dysregulation. This is all covered in my course, Old Money Mindset. You'll notice that I have 2 courses and they touch on 2 very different things that are so perfectly interconnected, because noticing when you are dysregulated is the first step of managing your emotional responses, of being emotionally regulated. I'm telling you guys, I didn't even learn how to do this. I didn't even learn how to notice that I was dysregulated until early last year, 2025. It took me 37 years to figure it out. And now I have the method that I have learned with hypnosis, therapy, reading, studying, understanding the nervous system and how it works. You have to notice when you're flooded, when you're freaked out, when your heart rate is up, when you're not thinking clearly, you're breathing shallow, you're not getting oxygen, when your amygdala has taken over. If you notice that, and you can pause, that's all you have to do. Notice and pause. Don't react. And I'm talking about when your husband upsets you, when your boss is a jerk, when a Karen leaves you a bad review, or you have something crazy happen. Notice that you're dysregulated and pause. And this translates into money, because if you can notice that you're dysregulated by anything that's going on, pause for at least 24 hours before reacting to market news, messages from your banks, sudden opportunities like, this is it, girl, come get rich with me. Calm decisions compound better. Dysregulated decisions are going to take you to chaos, okay? And the fifth thing I want you to do is I want you to build proof. I want you to give yourself some grace. I want you to teach your nervous system that you know what to do. I talked about this a few episodes ago of collecting evidence through seagulls. Seagulls are those clues, those things that are flying around your head. Like, I did good at that. So keep receipts of your competence. Like when you hit your savings milestones, when you pay down your debt, when you have your plans in place, when you make a good money decision, when you learn to trust yourself, keep a list of the things that you have done to show yourself how good you are with your money. Because when anxiety shows up, you can go back to this list and you don't argue with it. Show your anxiety the file. Show them the list of all the things that you've done well. Because one of the things that goes fast and first when we're dysregulated is trust in ourselves. And if you've been listening to this episode, we're on episode what, like 135 or something like that? If you've been an OG with me from the beginning, first of all, reach out, say hello. I love you so much. But all of these hours that we've spent together, at least 135 hours of building a regulated financial nervous system, you're doing the work. Quiet systems, steady choices, unbothered energy. So doomsday prepping is not about being called crazy. It's about doing what's best for you and your family, no matter who says what. And it's not about predicting disaster. It's knowing that if something does happen, you've got you. And that's what this is all about. That's what old money's about. It's about you've got you. You are unbothered. You are unshakable. You can take care of yourself. And that's all you need to focus on when things go crazy. You do not need to save the world. You do not need to knock down walls or start a coup or go do anything other than take care of yourself first. Take care of your family first. Make sure you are safe, you are regulated. And then that gives you the energy and the confidence to go out into the world and make a real change in a way that counts. Not in a way that's disruptive, not in a way that's dangerous for you or for others, but in a way that actually incites change because you are the adult in the room. I love you so much. I will talk to you on the next episode. And here's just to end it. Cancel, clear, get rid of any of the bad juju vibes. We are not having a financial doomsday. I hope all of us have a healthy, happy, prosperous 2026 and beyond. We are not calling in that energy. We are sending it back to where it came from because we are calm, cool, and collected. Okay, bye.